Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Helen Crane and Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, a boost for pensioners this week. But with the triple lock coming with such a hefty price tag, will the state pension become means tested? Meanwhile, a delay for the government's new online state pension top-up service. When will it launch? More issues with NS&I logins, plus a computer meltdown leading to a flood of customers being blocked from accounts. We have an incredible story of E.ON insisting that a part-time dance teacher did actually use £95,000 worth of energy in a month. And have I read that right? Amex, the card with the highest APR of any on record. That's 704.6%. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, older people got another big boost to the state pension this week, taking the full rate to over £11,000 a year. Now, this year's increase of 8.5% was thanks to the triple lock commitment, an expensive guarantee that the state pension will rise each year by the higher of CPI wages or 2.5%. But what will the future hold? Plenty of speculation that the state pension may become means tested. You have one reader, certainly, who has written in rather worried about this. Welcome to you all. Tanya, of course, to you first. Just talk us through, if you would, the rise to the state pension.
Okay, well, the state pension rose from Monday, so it will go up for everybody over the course of this month, and depending on when their date is. The full flat rate is now £221.20. That's a rise of about £900 a year to £11,500. That's if you're on the full flat rate for people retiring from 2016 onwards. The old basic rate is £169.50 now. That's up nearly £700 to an annual £8,800 a year. One thing that's important to note about the old basic state pension is that most people on it would have paid extra national insurance to get really big top-ups. I mean, some of them will be on, you know, £250 a week because some of these top-ups were so substantial. Some will only be on getting the basic rate, but that's because they didn't pay those extra contributions during their working life.
The sting in the tail to the rise in the pension is obviously fiscal drag, I suppose. More people pay more tax. Explain that.
Yes, well, the personal allowance is £12,570 a year. And obviously the full flat rate state pension comes in just below that. So you can see why if you have private pensions on top, even a modest private pension on top, means that you're going to have to start paying income tax, depending on your situation. And there have been some estimates on this. The Liberal Democrats got the House of Commons Library to do an assessment on this. And it's estimated that an extra 600,000 pensioners will have to start paying income tax this year. And that's going to rise to 1.6 million more pensioners having to pay income tax over the next 4 years. So that is quite a substantial amount of people. And the personal allowance has been frozen for several years, like the other tax thresholds.
I'm just going to briefly bring in editor Lee Boyce here, because Lee, whenever you put a poll on your website about the triple lock, whether it should stay, it's without question, was it 95% of people, if not more, say that absolutely it should stay and pensioners should get every penny, but the triple lock is really expensive.
It is expensive, and it's also become a very much a political, I would say it's a political subject as much as it is about finances, because we've seen it in the last couple of years when there's been rumours about triple lock perhaps being scaled down or changed. It's become a real political hot potato. And, you know, we've got a general election that's going to be coming up probably sometime this year, if not, it'll have to be early next year. But it's going to be another thing that's going to continue to rumble on. You know, we've seen it in the last couple of years in which we've had the average earnings part of it that skewed it 1 year. So in 2022, that was 8.6%, the figure that was used then. We've had runaway inflation last year, of course. So the CPI figure, 10.1%. So we've had some sizable chunks of that triple lock that have pushed the state pension higher. But in the same breath, you can have a look at what state pension payments are around the world, which we will talk about shortly, and the comparable of what people are getting in this country compared to other developed nations. And you could say, is the state pension enough? But it's a very expensive thing to continue to maintain. It will continue to be a really hot subject, no doubt. You know, what happens this time next year? Well, it looks like inflation isn't going to be the giant figure that it's been in the last sort of year or so. Potentially average earnings. So, you know, maybe it won't be as kind of hot as what it has been in the last couple of years. But you're right, it's very expensive. What happens is it becomes a bit of a generational debate as well. You know, younger generations feel like they're paying in to, you know, for the older generations to be getting their state pension. And then the older generation will say, well, I've paid in my national insurance contribution all these years and I deserve it. And then it becomes a very kind of polarized topic.
Well, Helen, I was going to ask you that, you know, probably as the younger person here. I mean, I got asked that on air. Is this the richest generation of pensioners with all of this state pension money and it's, you know, to the detriment of poor young people?
I'm only narrowly the youngest person here, but I will take that. Yeah, I mean, I do think there is some anger among younger people that the state pension costs so much, you know, especially when they're being told that they themselves might not be able to retire until, you know, they're 70, over 70 maybe, and, you know, they'll perhaps still be renting into retirement. You know, their retirements are going to look probably quite different to people who are retiring today. But that's the thing about pensions, isn't it? It's so long term, and older people today will quite rightly say, you know, this was a deal when I was working and I was paying in for all those years, and it's not fair that it should change. And you know, the other side of that as well is the reason the state pension has gone up is because costs have gone up so much. So it's, you know, it's not just kind of going up for fun. You know, pensioners obviously can't just increase their income. They're not working. They can't get a pay rise. So there's that element to it too. I think, you know, it has become this generational debate, but it's just a really tricky one to answer. Everyone, of course, when they get to old age, wants the best deal and feel that they've worked for all these years and they deserve it. So it's just a really tricky one to kind of square, I think, on both sides of it.
Quite. Tanya, I'm saying all this, you know, £11,000 is not really a lot to live on. And suppose the emphasis is on you yourself. So what are the options for the future? What are your views on this, Tanya?
Well, you can definitely argue that current pensioners are probably the richest generation of pensioners, but I think that's because they have these very generous final salary pensions. And when we talk about the generational issue, I think what we've got to remember is the younger generations will be even more reliant than the current generation on their state pension, because it's guaranteed for life in the way that final salary pensions are. Now, they're not going to have those final salary pensions, so the state pension is going to take on more and more importance to them as the building block of their retirement finances, because it is the bit that they're not going to run out of at some point. The state pension, it isn't, I don't think, enough to live on it on its own, but a lot of people do live on it. The very poorest pensioners can get pension credit, but that's set below the state pension level. So if you're on pension credit and that's all you're getting, you're really struggling to get by. The fact that it's not means tested, it's that there's a flat rate under the new post 2016 system. And that
what do you mean means tested? Just to be clear.
Well, there's no assessment of how rich you are when you get it. Rich people get it if they qualified and paid national insurance for the right number of years. And poor people get it if they paid in for the right number of years. If they didn't, then there's the option of pension credit for them.
Is that an option for the future? You have a reader question. Steve Webb has taken this on to answer it. But there's been a lot of speculation about the future, obviously, of the state pension. Will it become means tested? What are your views? How would that work? What did Steve answer?
Steve's short answer is no chance. I really encourage everybody who hasn't read Steve's column on this to go away and read it and hopefully be reassured. It's near the top of the pensions page at the moment, and it's a brilliant 10 out of 10 for answering an essay question for Steve Webb, because he goes through the way it's done at the moment, all the other options that are far more credible for keeping costs down, for instance, raising the age or raising the number of years that you need to qualify, for instance, from 35 years to more, or just keeping the increases under control. He's a former politician. He knows politics very well. And he really explains why there's this big fight over the triple lock every year. Older people vote. If you try to means test it for existing pensioners, there'd be such a huge voter backlash. I mean, I think he describes it at one point as political suicide. And then if you look at it for, say that you said to younger people, say, OK, we'll bring in means testing for people who are in their 40s now, because, I mean, that seems a little bit more politically palatable and we'll probably get away with that. He points out that for a politician, that is the worst of all worlds, because you get no current income, but you get all of the flak. That is why he's come to the conclusion that he has. If you're asking me for my views, I defer to Steve on this. It sounds like he knows what he's talking about.
I was just going to add here, so as Tanya said, Steve's this means testing element, he's kind of firmly like, this is not anything that looks like it will be coming in soon. We never know with the government and governments and what might happen. But he gives a couple of sort of alternatives to the mean testing route, because, you know, the cost of running state pension is increasing and it's expensive. And the first option he outlines here is to increase the state pension age, which is what we've seen happen anyway. So basically pushing the goalpost back to the age in which you can start taking state pension beyond 2028. It's a little unclear what's going to happen. So it'll be 67 by the time April 2028 rolls around. It's due to rise to 68 between 2044 and 2046, which feels like absolutely ages away. But there has been two separate reviews into this suggesting that age is going to be pushed forward to the late 2030s. By the time those reports have come around, it will probably be the mid 2030s. And then before you know it, it will just be quicker than you'd ever expect. And it does, he says, look likely that it will go from to 69 and to 70. It's been floated in various government reviews. You know, it's painful for people to probably hear that and think going to get state pension at 70. But it's anything I think they want to do to try and make it not means tested, this would be the number one thing that they'd be thinking about. The second thing is to increase the state pensions more slowly. So we've just talked about the couple of sort of bumper rises we've seen in the last couple of years. And he actually says, you know, between 1979 and 2010, which is a big slab of time, the state pension was pegged purely to inflation. And there was a notorious 75p increase in 2000, which I don't remember, but I'm sure it didn't go down very well. And if something similar happened these days, you've got the wrath of social media and all sorts of kind of noise that would be going around. And the other thing he says here is a third alternative is to make the state pension less expensive to provide. So he says the new state pension is loosely based around a 35-year requirement for a full state pension, so that's paying in national insurance. Whereas between 2010 and 2016, you could get a full basic pension for 30 years contributions. It says if the government wants to save money and not make it means tested, another tweak could happen. So to get a full pension, it might go from 35 years to 40 years. So there are the other options to probably, I would say arguably, probably more likely than a means tested state pension. But there are some countries in the world where means testing for pension does happen.
Well, Tanya, you've both got other countries, so what hell happens elsewhere?
Well,
what's the most generous state pension in the world?
I don't know if it's the most in the world, but our colleagues on Money Mail have done an assessment and looked at 8 developed countries, which, you know, could be considered on a par with ours. It looks like Spain is the highest on about 3,000 a year, but that is an earnings-based system. I think what you've got to remember with a lot of these comparable overseas ones is they merge the work-related, what we'd consider private savings, with the state savings. So it works in a different way from ours. I mean, we are encouraged, but it's not mandatory, that we build up a private pension on top of the state pension. But most people have had it in them by now that, you know, if you want a decent standard of living, you should be saving for a workplace pension or a SIP. You should be doing it privately on top. You've got to remember that they're paying for that large sum by doing what we're doing separately. Other ones that come out well are the US. That's well over 2,000, and also Germany. You have to work for 45 years to get the full amount, though. Another one that's of interest is Denmark, because they have a non-means tested one like us, and it's a flat rate for everybody. And that's a decent amount, and more than us, not one of the highest, but you have to pay in for 50 years to get the full rate to get that. That is a lot of years. And then there'll be very many people who don't reach the full amount there. Australia is always an interesting one, because they have pension freedom in the same way as we do, in terms of when you reach a certain age, you can sort of do what you like with your private savings. But they, Steve points this out in his column as well, they have a compulsory savings situation going on there, and it is also means tested. So, I mean, that's a very broad overview of the findings, but it is interesting to look how others do it. I mean, there may be some things that work well in other countries that we could consider here, but you've also got to think of the cultural issue. I mean, pensions are quite hard to understand, and simplicity really goes a long way. People understand the state pension. Going against the cultural grain with something that we've had since, I think, 1909, it was launched, and that everyone accepts and is used to, well, there'd not only be a big backlash, but there'd be an extraordinary amount of confusion. We only had 2016, seems ages ago now, but that was a really big upheaval, and, you know, we haven't had that in place for very long. So yeah, I think that the people who want to talk about radical, you know, change need to bear in mind, you know, how people relate to pensions. Most people do not spend a lot of time thinking about it or trying to understand it, and the broad outlines of it and how simple it is actually really, really important.
It is indeed. Lee?
I was going to say, I found this piece of research from my colleagues at Moneymail really interesting, actually. It's a really good example of how to properly do an infographic, which is just super interesting. And actually, Tanya and I were talking about it this week, and I said I was quite surprised about the US. And I guess because I'd completely forgotten that they have Social Security. And this is what this is, as Tanya pointed out to me. I was like, oh, of course, yeah, Social Security. Just because it's named something else, it sort of throws you a little bit. But the two things I was going to point out from in here. So of the eight countries that were kind of looked at in this piece of research, I think Australia and Denmark are probably the two most interesting ones to look at from a perspective of, could something similar happen in Britain? So Denmark is going to have a state pension age of 69 by 2035, which will make it one of the oldest countries for retirement age. Everyone gets a basic amount, as Tanya just said, but then they have a pension supplement, which I think is quite interesting. So that is means tested. So essentially, the poorer people, the poorest in society get more than the richest in society. So, you know, Denmark's a fairly affluent country anyway, but I think that's quite interesting. Now, the other bit of this is Australia. Now, what Australia tends to do, we quite often follow, because we're very similar culturally, and we Australia has a far smaller population, but it's sometimes almost like a bit of a testing ground to see how these things sort of go on over there. So auto enrollment is the big example of that. But again, they have a means tested pension that's going to be going up to 68, and it's actually a very similar amount of money to what we get here. And the amount Australian pension receivers means tested dependent on how well off they are with the poorest receiving the most. And then basically what happens is, what was interesting about this is, you say to yourself, well, if you do that, does that stop people saving into their private pensions, right? Because if you build up a massive, this is where I think the crux of all this comes from, is that we are told to now save very heavily into our private pensions, great tax relief on it, and we've been also enrolled, and it's taken all of the kind of sort of thinking out of it. But then people go, well, hold on, if I build up a massive private pension, I'm going to get a small estate pension, so why would I do that? But the Australians have kind of thought ahead on this, and its pension scheme, its private pension scheme, is actually mandatory. You can't opt out of it like you can in this country. You must contribute to it, and you have to contribute a certain percentage of it. So I genuinely think that's how most people would think of this. If you're going to say to people your estate pension is going to be means tested, it throws your private pension into doubt, because you go, why am I going to put all of this in it only to get to retirement age and then be told actually you're going to get a far smaller state pension because you've been too successful in building up a private pension? And it gets very complicated, it gets very murky, and that's why I think it's very difficult to get a means tested state pension over the line.
Well, let us know what you think. What would you think that the state pension should be means tested? Lee, if anyone wants to get in contact with us, let us know their views. We might read it out on a later show.
Yeah, editor at thisismoney.co.uk. We're always interested to hear people's opinions on everything we talk about.
Absolutely. Before we put pensions to bed, one more story, Tanya. New online service for people to check whether buying state pension top-ups, it's going to be worth it in retirement, is delayed. That's despite government assurances it should be ready by the end of the financial year. The current system, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, is a big old faff involving phoning both the Department for Work and Pensions and HMRC. I'm not surprised this is money readers aren't very impressed with the current system, Tanya, but we can have this up and running anytime soon. What is this state pension top-up system and when will it be ready?
Well, it's a new online top-up service that has been promised where people will be able to check it's worthwhile, which is very important, and also then make the payments. There will still be a lot of back-end stuff involving recalc, you know, taking the payments, changing your NI record by the HMRC, and then the DWP having to recalculate your state pension. And it's not clear how streamlined that is going to be. But certainly at the front end, in terms of the purchase process, it should make things easier. Obviously, it depends on how well it works and also the kind of backup it gets for people who might struggle with it at the beginning. There's likely to be quite a lot of pent-up demand for it. People who know this is coming, if they have got time to delay making top-ups, are probably delaying it. So I think we can expect another big rush when it is eventually launched. They did say that they were, you know, working towards the end of the financial year for a launch. That's obviously now passed. The reason they gave was that they were going to update the NI systems first, so everybody's most up-to-date records were already in the system. It took a bit of a while to get out of them, you know, what exactly that was and how long it was going to take, but they did eventually say after we published the story that the systems update would be done by the 9th. That's obviously a few days ago now. We've still heard nothing more about it. They have promised to tell us as soon as they're ready to launch it. I mean, I assume that it's still being tested and they don't want to launch something that isn't going to work. I mean, we get complaints about the top-up system all the time, and I'm sure we'll be the first to hear if anyone's got any gripes with it. We'll probably get a lot of useful feedback from people about how it works when it does launch. So yes, so we don't know, and we're waiting.
Watch this space. Tanya, thank you so much. Right, following on from my rant the other day on the pod about NSNI's online platform, I am pleased to say This Is Money have delved a little deeper into the login issue. But it's not just me moaning. Since NSNI introduced a new system to check premium bond accounts 2 years ago, This Is Money's mailbox has seen a steady flood of readers contacting them to say they're having problems logging in. Meanwhile, a 4-day computer meltdown at NSNI has been blamed on a technical issue that led to a flood of customers being blocked from their accounts. Helen, I'll be honest with you, probably wouldn't notice if there was a complete computer glitch. Logging issues. What's wrong? Remind people who probably didn't have the joy of my rant about NSNI and its online offerings.
So you're certainly not the only one, Georgie. As you said, we've had quite a few readers get in touch about this. Basically, we've looked into the case of one particular reader who said she was just having terrible problems getting into her an SNI account. This was just before the latest round of premium bonds winners were announced. So clearly there's a lot of people very excitedly trying to log in and see whether they've won a big prize. And this reader told us that, you know, she's a tech savvy person, normally doesn't have problems with these kind of things, but she'd tried logging on a computer, on her phone, nothing. She'd updated her browser, all of those things that we know we're supposed to do when things go wrong. Just absolutely could not get in to her NSNI account. So we had a look into this. This is our savings reporter, Helen Curran, had a bit of a dig. And it seemed that this was due to two-factor authentication. So NSNI introduced this a couple of years ago. This is a thing we see on all kinds of banking and sort of finance apps now, where you try to log in, then you get a code sent to your mobile phone and you have to enter it, and then it lets you through to your account. So she was doing that, but when she entered the passcode, it just still wasn't working. So Helen got in touch with NSNI to say, you know, what's going on here? It seems like she should be able to get in. She hasn't been able to. And they came back with this really strange sounding answer. They said it was due to something called time drift, which, as I think Lee said to me the other day, it sounds like something out of Knight Rider. It sounds like some kind of sci-fi phenomenon, time drift. But what NSNI say time drift is basically when the time on your device, so your laptop or your phone, is slightly different to the time that NSNI's system runs on. So that basically means that you can't log in. Which I just find so strange, because I mean that sort of plausibly seems to make sense. But then if that's a thing, why are we not hearing this all the time from our sort of banking apps? And, you know, if your phone can be 100% like plugging it out and it stops you, like why is this not happening absolutely all the time? I think it's exactly. Just quite a bizarre thing, seems to me anyway.
Are they running on a different internet or something? I mean, from 1953.
I mean, it's the government, sorry. So it's quite possible.
Well,
it?
Quite. Exactly. Lee?
Yeah, I was going to say, the time drift thing, I actually described it as quite quantum leap, not Knight Rider.
Yeah, sorry, Lee.
It's okay.
You
it's
naming
right.
Any generic sci-fi based theories, apologies.
But yeah, this is a strange case. And what happened was, the full story of this is that we put this out on Monday morning, and then Helen Curran sort of said to me, I think NSNI is actually just having a big kind of meltdown in general, because we started getting quite a few emails coming through the inbox, and we had a sort of dig around on Twitter, and we were like, okay, there's something bigger going on here. I couldn't log in. There was an error message at the top of the NSNI website on Monday night, basically saying that we're aware of an intermittent issue with the website while logging in, and we're working hard to fix it, blah 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 blah. Thank you for your patience and sorry for any inconvenience it may cause. Now, I have a degree of sympathy a little bit with NSNI, just because it does have a lot of customers. It has a lot of people that you know, do invest in premium bonds and other products, and it does have an unusual, I'm sure, surge of people logging in at the start of the month to go and see if they've won a prize. But it was just kind of strange how this had unfolded, and it went on for 4 days. So we were told it started on Saturday, it went all the way through into Tuesday, and we don't know how many people were blocked from logging in, but we had a lot of people writing in saying, I can't cash out on bonds and I need them. We had someone writing in saying they needed to log in to get proof of funds for a house purchase. You know, there's a lot of that kind of thing that was going on. You know, 24 million customers is a lot of people to be dealing with. But, you know, at first it kind of blamed this heavy online traffic and said it was some system updates. And then later on kind of said, actually, no, it was a technical issue, which is just all sorts of kind of like weird kind of way of dealing with this. And it almost felt like they wasn't too sure what was going on. And then bearing in mind that Monday was the 8th of April, that's almost a week since the premium bond draw. I'd find it very unusual if they'd had more people logging in over the weekend and on Monday and Tuesday than they did on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday last week, as people were checking their prizes. So very unusual case. The time drift thing is just absolutely bonkers in my mind. As Helen said, I think the real crux of it is, why does this not happen with other banks? You know, most banks now, most financial institutions use two-factor, you know, it's another layer of security for people, which can only be a good thing. You know, we don't want to have our savings raided and current accounts raided and all that kind of stuff. So it makes total sense to have two-factor. But we have we've had a steady stream over the last 2 years of people that have just not been able to get this two-factor to work. And it's frustrating for people, because I feel like what NS9 needs to do, and it almost needs a sort of section of its website, a kind of dummy's guide of, have you tried absolutely every single one of these things to log in? Because it's frustrating when you keep on trying and trying and trying. Who would have known about this time drift issue? Like, you know, who would have thought, I need to reset the clock on my laptop to be in sync with NS&I in order to get to my premium bonds? I mean, it just sounds, as I say, it sounds something like Quantum Leap. It just makes absolutely no sense to me. So anyway, if you are having problems, you know, get in touch, usual drill, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. And we'll see if we get more people writing in saying they're struggling.
Well, what can you do? Another sort of, not a swipe at NS&I, Helen, but you do have a piece on your website. I'm a savings expert. Here's why I believe NS&I will have to boost premium bond prices. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so this is from Sylvia Morris, esteemed savings expert on our sister title, Money Mail. You know, she's been covering the market for years, and she's kind of predicting that this year NS&I is going to have to put its premium bond prize rate up. Obviously, they did raise it a few times a couple of years ago when savings rates going higher. They've since reduced it back a little bit, I believe. The reason why she's saying this is going to happen is that NS&I, we talked about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, I think, they've launched this British savings bond, kind of launched with much fanfare. This was part of the budget a few weeks ago. They haven't kind of been what was as much of a sort of big deal as might have been expected. She's called them a bit of a damp squib. So they're a three-year bond, and she described the rate as mediocre. So they're 4.15% interest on those and 4.07% if you want monthly interest, which compared to what else is out there on the market, frankly, isn't great. They're also a three-year bond, which aren't really very popular. People much prefer 1 year. So Sylvia's saying that these British savings bonds probably aren't going to have much uptake. And if NS&I wants to keep getting new customers, keep their existing customers, they're going to have to put the rate up on premium bonds, because otherwise, essentially, customers are going to start filtering away. So could be good news for premium bond savers if they do decide to do that. But essentially, she's saying that these sort of British bonds probably aren't really all they've cracked up to be. And premium bonds are by far obviously the most popular product that NS&I has. And they're going to have to improve the rate on those if they want to keep people interested.
All right. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by David Kell of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Invest Explain feature. David, welcome to the podcast. Now, gold, it's safe to say, is having a bit of a moment with investors around the globe at the moment. So what's happened to the price of gold so far this year?
Well, year to date, it's risen over 10%. In fact, gold prices hit all-time highs on Tuesday, in fact, when it reached $2,365 per ounce, or the equivalent of £1,850. And it started at the beginning of the year at $2,062, which is about £1,650. So it's really rising quite significantly at the moment. Generally, gold's seen as a safe haven, and it's a way of diversifying risk, particularly when used as a hedge against inflation. And higher inflation is one of the reasons the gold price has been propelled higher over the last year, along with geopolitical risks that there are. In addition, gold performs well in times when the dollar has got weakness, as it's priced in dollars. This will also have had a big influence on the gold price.
And what happens next to the price? Is it going to keep rising, do we think, over the course of the next year? Too difficult to predict? What's the kind of verdict?
Exactly that. Forecasting the future price, it's just incredibly difficult. And you'd have to consider various macroeconomic indicators, such as the interest rate changes by central banks, inflation expectations, currency movements, again, geopolitical risks, and investor demand. If rates are lowered, It could restore investors' risk appetite, and therefore money may flow from these protected or protective assets like gold into riskier assets like equities. And these outflows could cause a fall in the gold price. However, should the opposite occur, this could push the gold price even higher still, maybe even reaching new highs.
Well, there we go. Could reach new highs. It could not. But we'll see what the rest of the year has got in store. Okay, thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Crane. Back on the case. Reader Question Time. An amazing story. Let me just run through this. I'm a part-time dance teacher. Not me, obviously. Running a small dance school for young people, open for about 15 hours a week. I've been running the studio for 6 years, and the bills are usually no more than £200 a month. Still expensive, but, you know. But last November, Eon sent me a bill for more than £95,000 for 1 month and told me it would be up to me to prove it wrong. Your reader also had an email which said that she should continue to pay the bill in the meantime. Not helped by the fact the figures kept changing. She says she's worried about the impact of not paying my bill and all the other things that are associated with not paying your bills. Helen, I thought I had problems with British Gas when they thought I was a business. I was never charged £95,000, that's for sure. What on earth's going on here?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? So this £95,000 figure is obviously ridiculous. Her normal bills for the studio are about £200 a month. You know, she saw that bill and it's so clear that she didn't owe that. But I think the worrying thing is, if they can make mistakes like that, what small mistakes are being made which are on money that people might actually plausibly think they owe, right? So say if your energy bill went up by £100 one month, you know, you'd think, well, that seems high, but maybe it's plausible. I'll just pay it. And, you know, I've done a lot of stories like this on energy bills. And I think the real thing is, how much is that happening? And people are just saying, yeah, well, bills are more now, so that could be right, and just paying. I do think it's a really big issue. With this case specifically, I think also the thing that's ridiculous is she got this bill, she contacted Eon, and they should have said, oh yeah, of course, that's not right, we'll sort it out. I think the first person she spoke to Eon did actually say that, but then she got passed on to another department. And as you say, they said to her, well, you're going to have to prove this wrong. You know, this looks like it's in line with your meter readings. And she was like, sorry, like, what, how on earth is that possible? I mean, it's almost laughable. And then she got this automated email. I think it was automated, in fairness, it hadn't kind of come from a real person, but still saying, we're looking into this and you should pay your bill in the meantime, which, I mean, it's insane. She doesn't have £95,000 to just pass over to you on while it works out what's going on. The other issue with this is in the studio, she had a sort of an old fashioned dual rate meter, and these can be really tricky to understand. It was one of those where, you know, you have to press a button to get the other rate to come up, and it's not always clear which is the day rate, which is the evening rate. So she hadn't read her meter, which Eon had also kind of tried to use as an excuse, say, oh, well, you know, this will happen if you don't read your meter, which is just absolute rubbish. You know, okay, it's obviously a very good idea to read your meter. It's good practice to do that. But if you don't do that, that doesn't mean it's your fault that you get a ludicrous bill. It just makes me really angry. I think the attitude, and it's not just Eon, of a lot of energy firms, is just like, well, you know, you think your bills are, well, it's probably your fault, isn't it? You know, you probably done something wrong. And I just think they're dealing so badly with this influx of customers who are sort of worried about their energy bills, who've got problems. And like, broadly, energy firms just seem to be dealing with them absolutely terribly. You know, the customer service seems really poor in a lot of cases. And I just think it's really not good enough, to be honest. But ran over. So in the end, I contacted Eon, and it took them quite some time to, they wanted to go out to the studio and check the meter. They wanted to send meter readings over a week to check what her uses actually was. She did all this, but it did take 3 or 4 months for it to be sorted. Also, in the meantime, she got another bill for £4,000 for a month. So it's really up and down, clearly sort of no idea what was going on. But in the end, she did get it sorted. Her bills are now back to about £200 a month, which is good. But Eon's response, they also put a smart meter in, which, you know, a lot of people don't like smart meters, and there are valid reasons for that. But she personally was happy with it because, you know, it makes her life easier. She doesn't have to submit readings. But when, after Eon was sorting them out, I asked for their comment on it. And they basically said, we're glad to resolve this issue for this customer, and that she's now seeing the real benefits of having a smart meter in her property. I mean, this is a terrible error. Don't use it as an excuse to just plug the benefits of smart meters. I mean, it's just, this wasn't solved by a smart meter. This was a mistake that you made. I just find it absolutely outrageous, if I'm honest, but it is sorted, which is good.
Lee, I honestly, really, a computer says no probably all the way on this one, because no one can be that stupid to think that someone whose bills have been £200 for the last 6 years are going to... What on earth would you have to do to use £95,000? Like an industrial power plant or something?
I was going to say an industrial cannabis farm after watching the Genesis on Netflix. Yes, possibly for something like that. But I think this is, on a serious note, I just think that... you know, these energy companies should just have a department for outrageous bills, which, you know, if it's over a certain amount, I think it should just go through to some sanity checking kind of department in the energy company going, you've got £95,000 and there's never been anything like that. Oh, let's go and find out what on earth is actually going on. But instead, it becomes all so difficult to try and sort out, and then people have to get in touch with us. And we'd rather people didn't get in touch with us to tell us about their crazy energy bills. We'd rather the energy company just got it right or sorted it out in the first place and just turned around and said, cool. And the thing that kind of really irks me about this one in particular is there's lots of people in this country that give up their spare time to run small clubs for the improvement of, you know, the lives of children, for example, that, you know, as a father of a daughter that goes to a dance club on a Saturday that is very inexpensive, that goes to Rainbows, that goes to all these little clubs that they don't exactly make the people that are running them huge sums of money by any means, any stretch of the imagination. It was the line in that story which she was saying, I'm going to have to close this down. You know, I'm going to have to close this dance school down because A, she was just so stressed by the bill, but B, you know, being told that she was going to have to pay this bill still, I think this completely stressed her out. And I think that it does feel at the moment that a lot of these small sort of clubs and organisations and things are just getting it from all angles. And then I think it's just, you know, quite upsetting to read that it's obviously her passion. She's obviously not doing it to make oodles of money, and she does it because she enjoys, you know, I guess, seeing children grow and develop and become better dancers. And then on the same side, we've got some energy firm, some big, bad, ugly energy firm saying, oh, your bill's like £95,000, pay it. Pay it while we investigate. No.
I know, so poor, so poor. Helen, you touched on it when you said, just imagine all the other littler bills that are not, you haven't had to have a department for outrageous bills by all means. But what about those, you know, poor pensioners who are being charged, you know, 15 quid extra a month? It doesn't seem a lot, but it all adds up, you know?
Absolutely. People contact me about this all the time. It almost daily, I have someone emailing me saying, I think my energy bills are wrong. And it's just, it's so difficult to make them see that you're right. I mean, energy is complicated, right? I mean, before bills started going up, no one really knew how many kilowatt hours they used a month on average. You know, people, you know, it was something that for many people, energy was largely affordable and you just kind of paid your bill and got on with it. But I think now people are identifying these problems. And I just wonder, like, has this always happened? Like, have there always been tricky little errors in people's energy bills? I mean, maybe they have, and now they're only just noticing it. And I think from what I hear from people, it can be really difficult to get that through to the people you speak to at the energy fair, if you even do get through to them, because some of them have such long call waiting times. And, you know, it requires you really kind of going through your bills with a fine-tooth comb and saying, you know, well, on this day, you say that I use this amount of energy, and that's I've never used that amount of energy in a day in my flat or my house before. And it's like the energy ones just start from a point of not believing people And I just think that's completely wrong.
Just a quick one, because your reader was really concerned about the impact that this would have, notably on her credit score. I mean, it's always worth, isn't it? Even if they say they've rectified a situation, to check your credit score. But what are the impacts that could have happened for not paying your bill, not being able to pay a 90? I mean, who's got £95,000 down the back of the sofa? What are the impacts?
Exactly. Well, yeah, that's a black mark on your credit score. You know, if you have a unpaid energy bill, that's something that would show up, you know, your debt to an energy firm. You know, ultimately they could issue like a CCJ or something like that if it went to that stage. So yeah, it can be really serious. And even if it doesn't get that far, you know, being threatened with debt collectors, I hear this from people all the time. They say that either my energy firm has threatened to send a debt collector on me. I've had letters from debt collectors. In extreme cases, even debt collectors have turned up at my house. And it's just, it's beggars belief, really, for people who are adamant that they haven't done this. Yeah, it can be really serious to have an unpaid energy bill. And if that does happen to you, obviously, once you've worked it out with the firm, go to the credit reference agency and, you know, check that it has been wiped from your credit score. If it hasn't, go back to the energy firm and say, you know, we've agreed this and I need you to contact them and get this taken off my credit file, because they don't always do it. And yeah, that could have really serious consequences if you're applying for a mortgage or for a credit card or something like that. So definitely, if that does happen to you, worth checking up that it's been removed.
Good advice there, Helen. Good advice. Right, Amex, the card of choice for your discerning business traveller. The American Express Platinum Card comes with a somewhat hefty £650 annual fee, but in exchange you get benefits including worldwide travel and fine dining, no doubt. Yet it comes with the highest APR of any card on record, 704.6%. So forget the worldwide travel and fine dining, Lee Boyce. Why on earth would you get one of these?
George, this is one of those classic ones, stories where I was walking through Liverpool Street underground station earlier in the week, and I walked past the advert for Amex, massive advert, really huge on the platform. And I walked past it and I saw 704.6% APR, walked past it, and then it sort of clocked in my brain. And then I sort of semi-walked backwards to make sure I had read that right, because it just looked absolutely bonkers on this poster. So this Amex Platinum card that was being advertised here, it's the reason for that high rate is because of that £650 fee that you mentioned. It has to be built into the APR for advertising purposes. The actual purchase rate of the card is 31%. But I think it's still notable to see that as a personal finance journalist. You look at that and you go, wow, that APR sounds absolutely bonkers. So I thought to myself, let's do a story on it, because I'm sure people are interested. And you're right, there's quite a few perks that come with this card. It has to be for £650 per year. And really quickly through this, you get things like airport lounge passes, £100 a year back when you spend at Harvey Nichols, love that, £150 in restaurants abroad, £150 in restaurants in the UK. And there's lots of little things. But I think actually the best way to describe this and tell you why people have it is to actually tell you from someone that's got it. And it's not me. Don't worry. No, I haven't got a £650.
That's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, I've never been tempted by something with a kind of high annual fee. But someone actually got in touch with us on the back of this story, wrote into This Money at the editor's inbox. And I thought it was really interesting. Someone that's got the card and kind of went step by step why they have this card. So this is someone who works in financial services, so obviously has an interest. Hopefully they don't work for Amex. It says he works for financial services and says that he has a £650 card because, as I say, £150 dining credits in selected restaurants, then £100 a year shopping credit in Harvey Nichols. Then he put in brackets, and it could be used in the bar, which I thought was quite interesting. So obviously gets the money back in that way. Said he had excess free car hire, and he said he saved £300 on holiday hire last year with the card. And you get an upgrade to president class, which sounds very posh, which gives you a car upgrade and other perks. And the access to airport lounges, as I just mentioned. He says he travels almost weekly by air with his job. So based on a £25 sort of weekly visit, you know, saying that's 100 quid a month as it is, takes advantage of upgrades with Hilton and IHG. Says there's other perks that he doesn't take advantage of, for example, early and unique access to events, often in London. And he said, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone that can't, you know, at least cover the cost of the card with savings and measurable discounts, but it is well worth having it in his wallet. And he says he has a corporate credit card, which isn't this Amex, which he uses for business travel, but he uses the Amex Platinum for most other things, hotel upgrades. Also says it's got travel insurance with a worldwide policy, which is, again, very handy. He could take two guests in free of charge into these airport lounges. He says his wife has got a free version of this Amex Platinum card. So when you become an American Express card holder, you can have a nominated card holder with you. So his wife can also spend on the card. Can be dangerous. Take it from me. I've got an Amex in which my wife is the nominated beneficiary of being able to spend on her own card, which is in my name. The two things he says about it is also that you probably going to need a 999 credit rating to get one, and probably a fairly sizable salary. And that fee, that 650 quid fee, isn't a monthly thing. It comes out in one big whack on a month. So he said it's just come out for him, and he said it's a thud, regardless of income. So I think it's really interesting. I think that we spoke about this before on the podcast. There are people that take advantage of these kind of really sort of high roller, high baller type kind of cards, credit cards, charge cards, reward cards. And we'd love to hear from you. So do get in touch if you're in that category, because I just find it fascinating. I find it fascinating that 650 quid for at first glance for having a card that's made of metal, you go, you boil it down, you go, you know, it comes out in one monthly FUD, but you know, you're talking what, 50, 60 quid a month if you break it down that way. And if you're managing to get things back and you claw that 650 quid fee back from the purse, it's worth it. It's almost like going in on all inclusive and saying, right, this part of the all inclusive cost me £1,500 and I'm clawing it back one beer, one meal, one.
Yeah, exactly. Gonna get my money's worth.
You're chipping away at it. So it's almost, that's how I see it with this fee. 650 quid fee. I'd have like a whiteboard or a spreadsheet.
Yeah, I bet you would.
Used airport lounge, which would usually cost £40, minus that off. Went on holiday and I would have bought one off travel insurance and it would have cost me this amount, shaved that off. And I think that's how you have to view a card like this. And it's quite clearly what this guy that got in touch. So thank you. I don't know if he listens to the podcast, but thank you. If you are listening to this and you were the person that got in touch,
whatever you use, make sure you get the most out of it. I mean, it would only work that when you said, oh, you know, 40 quid for a business lounge or travel insurance, if the travel insurance will cover you for what you actually need it for. If you would actually go to a business lounge, or you get real benefit from it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, rather definitely. Just, yeah, for not the that sake you're just of it. Doing it for the sake of it. Yeah, I mean, yeah. To do that would be pretty bonkers, because you'd have to pay for a flight and presumably a hotel and things. But yeah, and actually, George, it's a really good point in general, just with credit cards, that anything that you take out, like you have to play the game right, as we always say on this, because if you do not pay off the bill monthly, yeah, any kind of benefits are going to be negligible, because you're losing at the game. That's exactly what big credit card providers are going to want to do. You know, they're going to want you to trip up, forget to pay a bill, charge you big whack of interest, and then it's not so much of a reward perky type card anymore. But I would argue that most people that sort of like take out these cards are people that will do that. They'll know that they need to play the game. They're very well versed in paying off monthly and knowing all the perks and how they work. I find it a fascinating world. I think a lot of people, you know, people that are on sort of good salaries, you know, feel like they want something in their wallet that's going to reward them and give them upgrades and do things for them. You know, and this is clearly one of the cards that can do that if you use it right. And I guess, you know, most people probably, like me, would see that advert at first glance, say 704.6% APR. What? But at the same time, there's a reason for it, that fee. And it does offer, obviously, perks that people use. So I think it's a kind of, topic that's sort of interest maybe to people that kind of, you know, do want to get rewarded in that way. And I think there's more and more people that do feel like they want something in return for, you know, as I say, having a fairly good salary and wanting those perks and upgrades.
All right, Lee, thank you so much. Thank you, Helen. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
Yeah, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can also leave comments in the podcast article in which this will live.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy, cost effective, and flexible. Using our website or app, with our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.